Blog Talk Radio.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
And once again, I would like to thank Al Suarez for joining the program today. Al, I know it was on a very, very short notice. I just even this morning asked you if you would join, and you said, sure, I'll be there. So, Al, thanks again for joining the program.
You know you can count on me, comrade.
I know I can. Hey, tell me about that event that you were involved in there in Tampa. Because it seemed like you were really stirring up some heat. And when I say stirring up heat, you went where the heat was. Talk to us.
Well, yeah, I mean, the first protest from two Saturdays ago wasn't very impressive. We had about 15 people show up. But
what
last
was the
time around,
protest?
In the rain.
What was the protest?
Oh, it's solidarity with Ferguson. So you know,
there's
been over 100 cities now, I believe, that are protesting in solidarity with them against police brutality. And the last one I was a lot more people, and it was in the rain, most of it. It was like about 100 people, and about 8 people took part in the march, including myself. We marched towards the police station, and I've been trying to look up other protests in the country, if any of them actually occupied a police station, and I couldn't find anything. So we're the first to do it here in Tampa. Hopefully others will follow. But there was about 50 of us that remained for about 2 hours, give or take, literally in the lobby of the police station, demanding the cops to listen to our demands, which they refused. They claimed that the police station was closed, and it looked like we outnumbered the cops, and there was a standoff. They filmed us. We filmed them. Some media was there. We had our names written down. We were ready to be arrested, but it didn't come to that in the end. But, yeah, there was a standoff for a while. It got pretty intense.
Well, Al, it seemed like you really get you on the front lines, and, you know, we really appreciate everything that you're doing as far as, pushing the movement toward a socialist society, pushing the movement for working people, so we really appreciate that. Today our discussion is, what would the U.S. be like as a socialist nation? And we've had similar discussions on within recent weeks. Actually, we had A.J. Signeri, Alex Signeri. He was on just a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking and discussing with us the same topic on the similar lines. But what would the U.S. be like as a socialist nation? Now, Al, I was just speaking with you just before the program, before it started today. When we look at the Roman Empire, I always draw a lot of similarities between Rome and the U.S. And it seemed like Rome was the brainchild of this government. And actually the same backers, the backers of this country, they were around 2,000 years ago. A lot of people don't know that. They have been around for thousands of years. But anyway, when you look at the Roman Empire, very interesting, when you had the Christians, a lot of people don't realize that the Christianity was growing to a level that was virtually uncontrollable during the Roman Empire, at the height of the Roman Empire. And the Romans could not understand how they could take control of this movement. And Al, I might mention that the Christian movement, it was anything but peaceful. It was a violent movement. They believed in revolution. They believed in confronting the authorities and the government. And what happened, you have to understand, is that the Romans, when they couldn't think of any other way to control this movement, what they decided to do was to become part of that movement.
Yeah, they co-opted it.
Well,
yeah.
What they did is once they became part of it, they essentially adopted the movement. Once they adopted the movement, then they were able to infiltrate, because now they were working through faith and religion, and then they introduced religion and rewrote the Christian manual. And when you think about it, in Western society, we call it the Bible. We open up the Bible and we see how the Bible is written. A lot of people don't realize that the beginnings of Christianity and what they read in their Bibles came from the Romans.
The King James Bible in Britain took all the anti-authoritarian things out of the Bible as well, and the Emperor Constantine. There was distortions of the Bible. There is still some anti-authority left in there. But I was mentioning with you earlier before we got on the air, my first Ferguson protest that I went to over here, I ran into a Christian with a sign that said, "Jesus loves you." And I said, "If Jesus was here today, he'd be going to where I'm going to." And as soon as I showed up, he was having a debate with me, saying, "You know, oh boy, you gotta pray and read the Bible. It's all inevitable. Nothing we can do." You know, the same old, you know, Christian passive stuff. So, and then Reverend Bruce Wright spoke as soon as I showed up at the protest, and he said, "If Jesus was alive today, he'd be here." And I'm like, "Oh my God, I just finished saying that." So then they brought the loudspeaker over to me, and I talked about, you know, how I ended up saying that same thing, and you know. Jesus himself was revolutionary, you could say. You know, I mean, he kicked the money changers out of the temple.
Now, what I find interesting, as I mentioned, when we look at Christianity today, and we're going to get into this where we talk about many of the things that many of the proponents of this of socialism, which I am also a proponent of socialism, but I believe revolution should be in there. Now, when you look at, like myself, I'm a member of the Socialist Party USA. You know, I read, as you know, the socialist, the World Socialist website materials all the time. You know, you have the the Socialist Equity Party. You have the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You have many socialist organizations out there, but when you read their materials, it's very closely aligned, and we're going to get into that. But much of it seems like it's the pie in the sky of where, you know, people can live together in peace and harmony, and how we are take control of our communities and control our destinies and schools. And I'm not saying anything is wrong with that, but it seems like, when I see this on the surface, Alice seems like it's, we're talking about nothing but pie in the sky. Just today, Greg Payson, he's a personal friend of mine, and also he's a general secretary for the Socialist Party USA. Mm-hmm. He put out this information: the Socialist Party strives to establish a radical democracy that places people's lives under their own control, a non-racist, classless, feminist society in which people cooperate at work, at home, and in the community. Well, that probably wouldn't work too well on my block. Socialism is not mere government ownership, a welfare state, or a repressive bureaucracy. Socialism is a new social and economic order in which workers and consumers control production, and community residents control their neighborhoods, homes, and school. The production of society is used for the benefit of all humanity, not for the private profit of a few. Socialism produces a constantly renewed future by not plundering the resources of the earth. Now, as I'll get into a little bit more of that as we go along, but a lot of this seems like it's pie in the sky when I look at societies, not just here in the U.S., Al, but when I look at societies around the world. And,
well, Martin Luther King, if he was alive today, would have been shunned by these same Christians.
What was that?
Martin Luther King would have been shunned by these Christian groups if he were alive today, because they don't believe in activism. They believe in standing on the sidelines and letting the apocalypse come.
Right. Yeah, well, what they're doing, you know, it's like waiting for the apocalypse to come. We're going to be raptured. We don't have anything
right.
to worry about. You know, everything is going to be hunky-dory.
They
and
always
then we're
say the rapture's coming.
We're going to go to a place where there are streets of gold and everyone, you know, are just eating grapes and no one has to work anymore, you know. Now, I don't think that that's what socialism is about, but this is, again, this when you look at socialism, when you go back 2,000 years ago, it was about social change, and it was about confronting the authorities of the day. It wasn't about,
mm-hmm.
you know, waiting for the pie in the sky and change is going to come later. It was about, you know, change is going to come now. So anyway, my thing is, I want you to just comment on that, and then we're going to move on. I'm going to start speaking about some of these things when we look at.
Hey, but before we move on, I wanted to read
you
something.
Sure.
Can I read something now, or do you want
sure,
me to comment
please.
Something else?
Please, no, read it right now.
Okay, I wanted to read the article that I wrote the other day about Ferguson, and this is actually written. Shortly after the first protest that I went to. I haven't really written anything about the second protest yet. But it's called The Ferguson Civil War and the Meaning for Revolutionaries at Home and Abroad. And it was written on the 17th of this month. Let me start by giving two quotes that come to mind that are very relevant today for the situation in Ferguson. Hold on, let me close the door where I'm at. Just give me a second.
Sure.
Sorry if there's some background noise. All right. They're coming to get me. Just kidding. Let me start by giving two quotes that come to mind that are very relevant today for the situation in Ferguson and its overall repercussions in American society and the world over. Let me first paraphrase George Orwell, then give a direct quote from Trotsky. When the man who fired at me, when Orwell was fighting in the Spanish Civil War and was attacked by a Stalinist, missed, he said it was an accident. Then he exclaimed, I am a worker like you, which in other words means don't shoot me. I let it pass. I told him not to shoot at me again, unquote. Leon Trotsky exclaimed, the worker who becomes a policeman in the service of the capitalist state is a bourgeois cop, not a worker, unquote. Comrade Orwell did fight, after all, for the militia of the PUM party in revolutionary Spain, which was started by one of Trotsky's secretaries, Comrade Nin. They were the only ones fighting the fascists in Aragon, from their base in Catalonia, on the front until Stalin restored the bourgeoisie to Barcelona and eventually to the anti-fascist capital, Valencia, going after the PUM, who were comprised of anarchists and Trotskyists mostly, Orwell himself barely escaping from the grip of the Stalinists. We know this from Orwell's nonfiction work, Homage to Catalonia. Nin did not receive such a good fate. He not only was imprisoned, he was skinned alive before Stalinist agents killed him. Stalin effectively demoralized the anti-fascist cause, then right after their defeat in 1939, made a pact with Hitler, having supported Franco and the fascist cause of Spain alongside Mussolini. We see today a reemergence of history, with Spaniards now taking the train of revolution to join their own international brigades, except in eastern Ukraine instead, fighting fascists in a similar fashion, without Stalin's interference, without Putin's interference either. Rather than delve into an historical narrative, let me explain its relevance today into the Ferguson case as things continue to escalate there.
Mm-hmm.
We know from former police captain Ray Lewis of Philadelphia, arrested in uniform in NYC at an Occupy Wall Street protest, who in exchange had his pension almost removed, that police need to be insensitive to be hired. The theory is when cops take a sensitivity test, if they are too insensitive, when the police departments invest in their training, they will quit within days for not being able to handle seeing blood, therefore losing money. In reality, in the long run, the cops lose more money out of all the lawsuits that come about as a result. Cops are generation after generation in the police force are white, have favoritism, tend to be abusive towards so-called minorities, and get away with it. Predominantly white jurors exonerate them time and again, even when the case is quite obvious. Same goes for judges. The poor are targets as well, not just quote-unquote minorities. I say so-called minority, for worldwide, most people are black and brown. In fact, most people are poor. Even a poor person by American standards, let's say, would be considered better off in the quote-unquote third world, such as some African countries. even in the U.S., with darker-skinned people often having more children than whites, in a generation or two, the Anglo-Saxon in the U.S. would be a minority. They already are, if you consider the populations of Latin America. There is something, this is something Israeli Zionists fear as well, that the Christian and Muslim Arabs or Palestinians may outnumber them. That is part of the reason children and pregnant women are a particular target in Gaza. The Zionists do not want the already 1.8 million people in the small strip of Gaza to increase in number. How is Israel related? The police chief of the suburb of St. Louis, known as Ferguson, was trained in Israel, along with other law enforcement officials throughout the nation. Hence the fact people are treated as an occupied populace there now. The militarization of police, further impunity, and veterans with post-traumatic stress returning and now treating us as Iraqis, or whoever they occupied, as they're not getting help, all contribute to the current state of affairs we are in today. Should it be legal anymore for veterans to be cops in the U.S.? Should veterans be treated better in the VA? There's money to send them to battle but not take care of them. They were not trained to be cops but soldiers, and there's a problem in training when it's okay to fire on someone running away from you, like young Michael Brown was doing that fateful day in Ferguson. As we hear, this happens more and more. Oftentimes we heard at Occupy that cops are part of the 99%. They are workers like us. With Mr. Lewis and a few exceptions, I do not find that the case. I witnessed brutality from cops who guarded Wall Street, where the movement started. They are what former Mayor Bloomberg called in Boston his private army. They are paid well, not just by tax dollars, and they are used as pawns to repress dissent, including to target media, as was recently done in Ferguson. To put the unrest turning into a civil war in Ferguson, be a preview of what revolution can look like, how does the government respond differently to rioting versus nonviolent Occupy-like tactics? What is effective in accomplishing our aims? There's an ongoing debate on this. Another factor we need to take in is the intellectual inferiority of cops. I used to tell my fellow working class young people looking for a job to make sure they do intentionally bad on the IQ test at the grocery store so they can get hired, that they want dumb people so they cannot question authority and continue to be exploited as wage slaves. The way tests are set up, especially here in Florida, at lower academia or community college level, those that have the intelligence to question authority are shunned away as well. I did not realize this then, what I told my fellow comrades who are also smart but struggling, that the same theory can be applied to cops, quite literally. Also, most cops in the U.S. are overweight. Some prefer the bullet to the chase, especially if on foot. Before you say this is a false stereotype, recent statistics have shown 80% of cops here are overweight. To be fair, a big part of America is overweight, and this can be contributed to many things I get into another article. However, it is substantiated in the courts that you must have a low IQ to be a cop. A prison guard wanted to be a cop and was turned away for this very reason. He tried to get them on discrimination, but the judge sided with the police, and I provide a link with that. The reformists will come, like Al Sharpton, and try to calm the people. The cops are working class like you, blah, blah, blah. But again, consider history. As long as cops are silent in the face of corruption or injustice, as long as cops are used as tools to oppress us, the time for negotiating is over and the time for rebellion is now. The eyes of the world are on Ferguson. In the final analysis, I feel the opportunity for the revival of activism in America is here. I was recently at a protest in solidarity with Ferguson here in Tampa, and for the first time in a long time. We often protest online, but the real protest is when you're physically there, not just in spirit. Me, personally, am not against the police. I'm against the authority that orders and sets in motion these acts that some police are committing. The same can be said for soldiers. There's even an increasing amount of veterans who are homeless, who have turned into victims in society, and there are strong economic reasons. Some call the economic draft for many people to join the armed forces, including the minorities often sent to the front. Indeed, I have family who were in the armed forces and have a great uncle who was a traffic cop and gave his life for the city of Boston, dying in line of duty. I never knew him, but I know him to have been a decent man who was trying to help someone and ended up shot. So again, my views are not out of a vendetta for cops. However, as I am half Latin, I've been racially profiled and targeted by police before. My view is Marxist, analytical, and is founded in history as I strive towards social justice and a more humane and egalitarian society for liberty and justice for all, for true democratic principles. I remain in solidarity with people of Ferguson and all those oppressed and seeking justice.
Well, and I'm glad you were able to bring that up on the program so many of our listeners, they'll be able to... when we have this in our archives, they can be able to pull that up and share with other individuals. Thanks again on that. You know, you mentioned something about police departments and militaries. You know, one of the things I wanted to focus on the international platform of many socialist organizations, and some in particular, they call for, you know, which I've been a member of a couple of socialist organizations myself, affiliated with many. But when it comes to the militaries, and we're talking about police departments also, they believe that nations such as the U.S. should not have, or any socialist country should not have a military. What is your ideas on
Costa that? Rica doesn't have a military. The problem is that if a country is a developing country, is under the threat of imperialism, if they want to get rid of their army, they have to have a neighbor who's powerful that can defend them in case there is an imperialist invasion of their country. For example, if Venezuela, who has a strong army, has natural resources, oil, that can back their military and their people's militia, if a country like Venezuela had a strong alliance with Costa Rica, then it'd be realistic that Costa Rica had no army in case there was an invasion.
Is it realistic for the U.S.?
Well, I'm not saying that the United States should have no army whatsoever, but obviously there's too many military bases. I mean, I want a world someday where there's no weapons, but I am also realistic about the current state of things. And I think that if you're a Latin American country, you're under threat of U.S. imperialism. You know, consider the history.
Considering within the last decade,
and Honduras, and you have children leaving the country, and you know Honduras still has an army, but you know it's kind of concerning that Costa Rica doesn't, because Costa Rica that could be invaded if it doesn't have an alliance with other Latin American countries.
Well, considering that this country has created more than a dozen enemy states throughout the world, would it make sense if we, like tomorrow, start disarming this country? I mean, considering that we have had open threats against...
The U.S. military bases are symbolic. We have drones. We have, you know, naval
symbolic?
Vessels. I'm trying to say that we have
Over 750 military bases around the world.
What I mean is their military necessity is symbolic. Because if we close down all those bases, we'll still be strong because we have all those naval vessels that have drones and other missiles and other forms of warfare that we could attack those nations from the Persian Gulf and other regions in the world. So I'm saying that we don't even need those military bases. They're a waste of money. And we can still attack countries without those military bases.
I'm reading here, it says, and this is similar to many other organizations out there, we call for the closing of all U.S. military facilities. This is from the Platform of Socialist Party USA.
Okay.
We call for the closing of all U.S. military facilities at home and abroad that train foreign military and paramilitary personnel. We call for the United States to immediately and unconditionally withdraw its forces from Iraq and Afghanistan. We call for an end to the U.S. occupation of the province of Guantanamo, Cuba. Call for an end of end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. These are a lot of things I definitely agree with. West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, and an end to all U.S. aid to Israel as a precondition for peace. We support an immediate cutoff of all U.S. military aid to Colombia and all other recipients. We call for the abolition of the Central Intelligence Agency, which I agree with that.
Right.
We could do that like today.
The NSA,
and all other institutions of covert warfare. We stand for unconditional disarmament by the United States. So let's pause there for a minute. How do you feel about that? We stand for unconditional disarmament.
It depends if other countries are cooperating with disarmament. If you mean denuclearizing, I think that'd be a great idea. If all
armament. No, it says armament.
Yeah, but I don't know what it means by that. We have to get rid of our pistols,
that's
too.
Arms.
I mean, I don't know what disarmament is. But I agree
arms.
With denuclearizing when other countries are also going to denuclearize as well, you know.
Right. We call for an international treaty outlawing all weapons of mass destruction, including the use of depleted uranium and conventional weapons. We call for an immediate 50% cut in the military budget, followed by additional cuts with the aim at rapidly reducing the military budget to less than 10% of its current level, with the peace dividends directed to essential social services and to the cost of cleaning contaminated military sites. But when I look at this, and I'm not saying that this is impossible, but I don't know if we would be able to see this within the next decade. I think it's
possible.
It'd
be during the collapse.
Good point. Explain what you mean when you're saying that.
If the country's strong militarily, there's no way they're going to give up their power. If there's a total collapse of American empire, then there is going to have to be some denuclearizing. And I'm not anti-gun. I think we have a right to defend ourselves. So I'm not saying we should totally demilitarize and give up, you know, all our pistols and guns. But at the same time, you know, the nuclear bombs, there's no use for them. You know.
Now you're talking about a collapse militarily or. Excuse me, militarily or economically?
In every way. When the Roman Empire fell, their economy fell and their military fell. So it would be a collapse in every way, and then it would be inevitable, right? Then all those other things would be brought down.
Right. But now this is militarily what they're, you know, and like I say, it's just not one organization. And I'm not saying I disagree with a lot of that. I think much of it is like pie in the sky, something that may happen maybe 40, 50 years from now. If there's a collapse, it could happen within the next decade. But I'm going to move to another area when we talk about, you were talking about law enforcement, police departments. Now, many, and then we're going to talk about borders, but it's several things we're going to talk about. But I want to start with law enforcement. Many organizations don't believe we should have police departments. We should have no local law enforcement. And let me clarify, preface what I'm saying here, Al. I don't believe we need to have tanks in the streets. I don't think that we need to have police departments that are heavily armed by the Pentagon. And right now we have, just recently, the Pentagon has spent more than $500 million. And our listeners need to hear this, more than $500 million to arm local police departments. So basically we got the Pentagon, we got the U.S. government now in the streets. But what about local law enforcement? First of all, in some countries, they don't even carry weapons. But should we have police departments where they're patrolling with military-type weapons and also weapons on the street?
Well,
and should we even have police departments, period?
In New Orleans recently, there was a female cop who shot a guy in the forehead, and this didn't get a lot of coverage because he survived. But in New Orleans, law says that officers have to have a camera showing what they're doing at all times. And she simply turned her camera off and shot him in the forehead. So even if we implement that in all the cities, the cops have to have cameras on them at all times. They're free to, you know, turn them off. So when you have that passed, also put in there that there's strict penalties for turning the camera off.
My question to you is it possible that live in a society with no, whether it's private or public, no police on the street?
The police in most European countries have no guns, for example. So I think that to have a police force only with batons, perhaps pepper spray, you know, to use as a last resort, could be something that could be done. You know, the military, the ones that, you know, whenever they're needed, could have guns. But the police force, they don't even need to have guns, let alone be militarized and treat us like an occupied people.
So, in other words, I mean, from a socialist perspective, having police departments, having armed police, armed in one way or another is necessary, but we can't live in a society where there's no police. Because I guess back to what we were saying at the beginning of the program, the people that are looking forward to going to a heaven, you know, I don't think they're looking at having police, you know, just walking up and down those streets of gold, you know. So everyone's going to be happy and living ever after, heavenly ever after together. But here and now, even in a socialist society, you would need to have police departments. Is that what you're saying, Al?
Yeah, but, you know, it depends what you consider armed. I don't consider a baton armed. I think it has to be
right,
a loaded
okay.
weapon. But, you know, if there's they have to restrain somebody and they have to hold them down with a baton or maybe, you know, use pepper spray. I'm not an expert in that field. But, you know, you could use a simple device like that to subdue somebody. You don't have to use lethal force. I don't even think lethal force should be an option for a police officer.
And I agree. I believe that, you know, you need to have some police departments. When I was a member of the Peace and Freedom Party for close to 14 years, many of the members, you know, they spoke very much against police departments. We don't need police departments. And I kind of felt like, you know, I don't want to live in a community that, you know, if I need to have someone's trying to break down my door or get in my house at 2:00 in the morning, I want to make certain I can call and someone's going to show up at the door to, you know, help protect my house. Borders.
Because even if somebody has a gun or a knife, if you pepper spray their face, they're temporarily blind. So, you know, you could, you know, pepper spray them, maybe hit them to subdue them, and they could drop the knife or drop the gun or not know where to shoot or to stab somebody, and then you could restrain them that way. So even if somebody has a gun or a knife and they're trying to assault somebody, there's ways to subdue them. You know, but the way the cops are acting, if you're running away, you're going to get shot because they can't chase you.
Oh, yeah. Running away, if you're black, you're going to get shot. You don't have to run away. You can stand there and put your hands in the air.
Well, yeah, even
shot.
If you're not running, you get shot when you're black. But let me give you an example.
You know.
There's a white kid recently who's at a 7-Eleven wearing headphones. The cops gave him an order. He didn't hear them, and they shot and killed him. So it's happening
right.
to people all colors. And these cops
have
a low IQ.
You know,
like I mentioned earlier, they're
right.
dumb. They can't see that their headphones have music turned on. They're insensitive, a lot of times racist, and it's a deadly combination.
Right. I just want to make a quick pause here. Once again, I'd like to thank our listeners for joining the program today. It's Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. Today we have Al Suarez. He's joining the program. And what we're discussing, what would the U.S. be like as a socialist nation? And Al, thanks again for joining the program.
Thank you.
Al, I want to get into borders. You know, and this is something I don't believe the world – I don't like fences. I don't like, you know, this – before Bush went out of office, he spent $40 billion to build a wall, you know, on the southern borders. $40 billion, you know, of taxpayers' money. And it still has
really
proven very ineffective.
That.
You know, but, you know, here in many European countries – they don't even have any fences or walls, but they
no.
still have borders. But in do you think it's possible to live in a world where there are no borders and no walls? Is that possible?
Well, there's only borders on the map if you're an EU country. You could walk from, you know, France to Spain or France to Germany. And you don't have to show any form of ID. I've seen a picture of, like, the Belgian-Holland border. It's a cafe. And one part of the cafe says Belgium on the street. The other part says Holland. So there's literally cafes that border
right.
the two countries that half of the cafes on the other side, and they're not checking anything for you to go to the other side. That's
yeah,
how open
that
the borders are in the EU. And, you know, Trotsky called for a united social states of Europe. So there is some forms of socialism in the EU, and I think a social society would have open borders, and I think it's possible. It's already existing in some nations. You know, Americans tend to, you know, isolate themselves and not know what's going on in other countries or be pessimistic and say, oh, maybe we can have open borders in 50 years. Well, it's already being done
mm-hmm.
in other nations. We can do it here within a couple. We just have to implement some things and get rid of the wall. It's a waste of money. you know, get rid of our anti-immigrant policy and a lot of other things we can do.
Full employment. Is full employment possible?
I mean, I've heard stories of people that left their Eastern European countries at the fall of the Soviet Union and came to the United States, and they never heard of unemployment. It was illegal to be unemployed
right.
in their countries unless they were, like, severely disabled. But everybody was employed in their countries. And, of course, when the Soviet Union fell, you know, it was a complete disaster that they're still suffering from today. But in a social society or a socialist-based economy, there would be no unemployed unless somebody is severely, you know, physically incapable of working. And it's possible, even with few resources. Other nations have already done it historically. There can be a society where there's no unemployment.
Now, much of what we see when we look at borders and when we look at unemployment, we have to realize that under capitalism, all these systems come about under capitalism. Borders as a means where you can segregate people. Capitalists love to segregate people. It's like segregating, you know, livestock, you know, and you use them at will, and creating fences. And this is what the capitalists, what they do. When you look at employment, they create conditions where there's high unemployment, and then when there's a need to get cheap labor, then you bring certain people, you bring more people into the market, into the labor market. You bring them in, everyone's wages are far less. Now, today we have many people that are working part-time. We have over half the U.S. labor force are part-time workers. Is unemployment going down? Well, it all depends on how you look at it. You know, it's going down if you go by, if you look at those statistics that are spewed out at the end of each month by the government. But is it going down? It's only going down because we're splitting jobs. We're creating more.
Well, I'll tell you this. The United States is the only country in the world that counts as unemployed as people on only people on unemployment benefits. So if you were the lucky few that were eligible for unemployment benefits, or if you lost your unemployment benefits, you're counted as working. So
right.
you know the actual figures are
right, exactly.
depression figures for the youth. I mean, this is beyond recession. This 50%. I mean, up there with you know what's going on in Spain and Greece right now in their economic crisis. Similar figures to what we have in America up till now. So the government covers it up by only counting those unemployment benefits.
I'm going to take just a short pause here. I just want to read something, how certain people in the capitalist circles, how they look at socialism and how they try to demonize it. I was reading an article by the Independent Sentinel by Sarah Noble, what socialism will look like in the United States. When I read this, it's almost like a joke. They say, she had mentioned, there is a 20% sales tax on everything. There is a television, a TV tax, a radio tax, a dog tax, 50% death tax for many. Taxes overall totaling about 50% of one's income. And when I look at taxes under capitalism, she was looking at the model for capitalism, because I'm taxed from the time I get my check to the time when I pick up my next check, and I'm taxed everything in between. When I pick up an item in the store, I'm taxed on that. When I go and get gasoline, I'm taxed on that. When I look at my check, here's a chunk of it's gone already in taxes, and at the end of the year, the Internal Revenue Service is saying we need more taxes. So almost 40% of my income is being taxed. So apparently she was looking at that model there. And then it says there is under socialism, there is no central air. Very petty. There is no central air. It's something how they try to demonize socialism. Use dinky radiator heaters in winter. And I looked at that, Al, and I said, oh, she must have been thinking about the way it is in capitalism. Under capitalism, they just turn off your fuel. They just let you freeze to death. If you live in Detroit, you just don't get any water. They say, oh, you didn't pay your bill. Here in California, they say you need to pay your bill by 1:30. And if you walk in there and you give them cash at 1:32, They say, oh, you're 2 minutes late. We still had to turn it off, but you'll get it turned back on tomorrow.
There'll be a
reconnection
thing. Right. And there's a reconnection is a form of collective punishment because demographically, people that did pay their water bills, also got punished because they happen to be in the same neighborhood.
I am a working person. That happened to me one time. I missed the bill, and all of a sudden, I had to go and pay like $105 or whatever. I had to pay them almost $400 to get my water turned back. And they left it off for a whole day.
In my complex, if I wanted to bring a pet, I'd have to put a deposit on the pet. I mean, that's capitalism. I mean,
that's not a tax,
but capitalism is when you make fees for everything and rip people off, rip the working man and women off. Socialism is when the ones that are really taxed are the ones that can afford to be taxed, the rich and
check
the upper class.
Check this one out. Gasoline, this is, again, from Sarah Noble, gasoline is $7 to $10 a gallon because of government taxes, Mr. Obama's dream. Well, anyway, I would look in the last 7 years, gasoline has doubled. The cost of gasoline has doubled. Has your income doubled? No, it hasn't. They says people can't afford mortgages unless they are 50-year mortgages. Under capitalism, you know what happens, right, Al? You get a foreclosure notice, and they dump you out into the street. I mean, every item of garbage you throw out must be color-coded. You know, I didn't even know what color-coded was until all of a sudden
you'll
I saw a truck coming by that was green, and one came by that was brown, and they had different color trucks. And they were doing it because they enhanced the profit. Let me let folks know, every time you throw your garbage out in the street, they send that to recycling facilities, and wealthy billionaires are making money, super wealthy billionaires are making money off of your trash. Capitalism is all about profit. I'm not saying, you know, socialism is perfect, but capitalism has many flaws, and the many flaws it has, everything goes toward creating the profits for the wealthy few. Anyway, I had to get that out there, Al.
Yep.
Al, let's get in a little bit more in this because, like
I said, her next line was, "And I believe that Obama is a socialist."
Oh yeah. Well, I was going to read that one, the one that was in the. In the Washington Post, actually, it wasn't her. It was McCain and Huckabee, where they were up there saying that Obama was a socialist back in 2009, and all that was a bunch of garbage as well. Al, you know, I'm not saying that socialism, as I mentioned, I'm not saying that it's perfect, but a lot of it seems like it's pie in the sky. I mean, a lot of people think that socialists just believe in welfare and people being lazy and no one's working. But if you did have a socialist society, how would you ensure that, you know, everyone, people that don't want to work, in other words, someone say, you know, I'm just going to let everyone take care of me because I don't feel like doing anything. How would you deal with that in a socialist society?
Deal with what exactly?
If someone just felt like, I just don't want to work. I just want to settle my laurels and, you know, let people take care of me. And
lazy people should be either fined or in prison. It should be illegal to be lazy in a socialist society. It's really the opposite of what capitalists claim socialism is. Socialism encourages people to work and work with dignity. It discourages laziness. And statistically, in so-called nanny states, in governments like in Germany, which are thriving in spite of the economic crisis in the rest of Europe, the more social programs there are to help the poor, the less poverty there is. I mean, that's just a statistical fact. So the fact that it's so hard to get on welfare in the United States, or you're getting the bare minimum, actually increases poverty. So when you have a safety net, a way to get the help you need and get back on your feet and get back to work, it's going to help the economy and help end poverty. It's not going to do what the capitalists are saying.
Now, here's another one. Many, you know, socialists, I believe, I'll be 63 in a few days, Al, But I believe that people, seniors, should be,
hey,
you know, they should
have. Hey, you have the same birthday as me. You can't say it's 2 days. It's over a month. Come on, we're
okay,
October 1st.
We're going to celebrate. We're going to celebrate.
I'm going to turn 30 this year.
Oh, man, you're younger than my kids. Exciting. Hey, Al, I don't believe people should work from, you know, from the time that you know, from birth to the grave. I don't believe that should be,
no, obviously
it should
not
be like that.
Retirement
but,
should be guaranteed. Pension should be guaranteed. Absolutely. I think the pension age should be low, too, so they can live out their years. Maybe 60. Bring it down to 60. I was thinking
50. But, why 60?
Yeah, we'll see. But I'm just saying that, you know,
I'm trying to help you out here,
retiring. I have people that are physically able and of age to work. They should work, and they should earn the pension that they're going to get once they do retire, you know, and their family should be taken care of if they're killed in the workplace or anything like that, you know. It has to be a humane society.
I started working in a pie shop at the age of 15 years old. Al, I think after 35 years, that's over half your life. I mean, I think I've, you know, if I want to retire and be able to do things in arts or, you know, be able to go camping from time to time, go and explore, you know, my neighborhoods, the world, I think I should have that. I should be privileged to do that. But here it says, we call, again, this is from the Socialist Handbook, we call for the right of retirement at the age of 55. A minimum annual retirement income of $25,000 tax-free and protected from inflation by the cost of living. And I agree with that. Some organizations, they believe it should be somewhere between, you know, it ranges, depending on what group, between $25,000 and up to a little over $30,000. Is this a dream? Is it possible? Even you were saying, post-revolution or post the collapse, is that possible?
I mean, it is not only possible, I feel it's inevitable, because if we're going to survive as a species, we
right.
have to end this destructive system of capitalism or corporatism. It's just destroying us as a species collectively,
mm-hmm.
not only the American society, but globally. Capitalism, as we know, is destroying us. So it's either death or an alternative economic system. And I feel that the best of the alternative systems we have to offer is socialism, and it will eventually have to be implemented fully one way or another.
I'm going to get into just one more area when we talk about, like I say, I'm not – some areas of socialism, when I say pie in the sky, I think when, Al, from my perspective, when you're talking about going to heaven, I think that's definitely pie in the sky. You know, I don't believe in any type of heaven or anything like that. But, you know, but when you talk about many things in regards to socialism, I personally, unless you have some type of collapse and some type of revolutionary change, I don't think that any of this is going to happen within the next – definitely not within my lifetime, but I don't think it's going to happen within the next, you know, 50 to 100 years. But I'm looking at people when they were talking about, you know, the civil rights movement back in the 60s, and then we had, you know, Martin Luther King and President Johnson, they signed the Civil Rights Act. But, you know, Al, it doesn't seem like we've gone any further. Actually, it seemed like we have gone backwards, and if you look at over the centuries, I mean, there's no gains when it comes to any society when you look at race. And it's even worse here because, obviously, this country, we lead the capitalist world. It's worse here when you look at race relations, than anywhere else in the world. But
And they talk about the death of the middle class. The middle class is getting a taste of what the working class and the poor people have been going through for decades.
Right. So is it possible where you can have a society where you don't have that division based on race or, you know, class or, you know, based on sex, anything? Is that possible?
Right, right. I think that the only way that you can do that is with counterculture. You know, in the Unfinished Revolution book that I wrote, I talk about the importance of counterculture. is essential to the revolution. The revolution has to be intellectual, spiritual, and cultural. So there's different levels of the revolution. I mean, Occupy, for example, in the beginning, was more revolutionary than reformist. So the original occupiers in the movement, it was a political, social, and economic fight. So you have to deal with all of those aspects and build a counterculture. So the prejudices that we have, consciously or subconsciously, that dominate our current culture here in the United States in particular, has to be combated with a counterculture of sharing, of loving one another, regardless of race, regardless of gender, and for us to all be one social class and not to have a ruling class over us that are exploiting us and maintaining us with wage slavery and the bare minimum and welfare and things like that.
Al, I just want to just very briefly briefly take a pause. And once again, we have Al Suarez. He's joining the program today on Left Turn with Stuart Alexander, and our topic today with the U.S. be, what would the U.S. be like as a socialist nation? And Al, thanks for joining the program. We have like around 10 minutes to go here. Al, I'm looking at something I put out there, and people probably saw this. It says, if a socialist president were ever elected to lead the nation, we see a difference. Now, we have Bernie Sanders, which I don't believe he was a socialist. He was probably a socialist during his college days. And we have Dean Cohn.
Right.
He's running as a candidate with the Socialist Party USA as a presidential candidate for 2016. But without a collapse, Al, without a collapse, without a revolution prior to socialists being elected, would a socialist be able to make a difference? Will we see a difference if a socialist were
No,
elected?
Not at all. And I've talked about that with Dean Cohn as well. I mean, it's not realistic in the current system that we have that, socialists be elected and be able to make a difference, because they'd only be able to make reforms here or there. And how the system is set up today, those reforms would ultimately be meaningless. So you have to bring,
right,
you know, Congress people and corrupt politicians to a people's court, and there has to be a full revolution, a full transformation of the system, of the so-called two-party system. And then we could have more participation of the third parties and have, quite possibly, a socialist be elected and be able to make a difference.
Well, one of the things I find very interesting, we had, I'm not saying that John F. Kennedy was a socialist, but John F. Kennedy, he said all the right things to get elected as president back in 1960, and then he actually took his oath of office in 1961. But after he got in, he had a different agenda. I mean, he didn't want the war. You know, he was wanting to cut back on the military-industrial complex. Even when it came to the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, he knew that it was time to back off. He didn't want to push, even though the military was pushing for war, he said, let's back away from that. He was already, before Lyndon Johnson took office, he was pushing for various things, the civil rights movement. The same thing with a socialist today, if they were elected, Al, what I see is if they wouldn't be willing to conform their agenda to what we see under the current system, they would be in serious trouble. What is your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, Kennedy was a reformist. I think he was well-intentioned. But again, he wanted to make it look like they were Cubans that were taking over the government of Fidel. That's why he didn't want the United States to be air support or a ground invasion.
He was part of the system. Don't get me wrong on that.
Right. But there was members of the establishment that were more hawk that really disliked Kennedy as well.
And we know that he did oppose the Vietnam War. Well, it wasn't a war at the time, but he opposed sending a U.S. intervention in Vietnam. And, of course,
At that point, there was only Johnson there.
Johnson
said he wanted
to
de-escalate because he was influenced by the French, who had been kicked out of Indochina. Indochina was Laos, Cambodia,
and
Vietnam. So he thought if the United States invaded like the French did, that they could lose. So he was, hesitant to escalate it at that point. Of course, Johnson did the complete opposite.
I want to get your ideas on this Bernie Sanders. I'm sort of indifferent
the thing,
as
like,
far
makes
as
me
him
angry
as
Bernie
him,
Sanders.
Well,
is,
let me finish. Let me finish. I'm indifferent him as a congressman, as a senator, because you know he's a voice there, and you know, but he's talking about running as a presidential candidate and running as a candidate representing socialist values, but much of what he's talking about has nothing to do with socialist values.
Absolutely.
What are your ideas on Bernie Sanders?
I'd prefer a Democrat who's going to come and tell me I'm a reformist, I'm going to try to do this or that reform, than somebody who's coming to me and saying I'm a socialist and using the same rhetoric as a Democrat and supporting basically the same policies of a so-called progressive or reformist Democrat. So if he's going to do it in the name of socialism, that's deforming what real socialism is. And that pisses me off more than somebody I disagree with, but I respect because they're admitting that they're reformists. Then again, if you have to take a bigot, and Malcolm X talked about that he preferred Republicans over Democrats over this, because he said if you have to take a bigot who's going to be a bigot behind your back and a bigot to your front, who do you prefer? Who's more dangerous? The one behind your back is the one that's more dangerous, the Democrat. Because the Republicans will be just overtly bigots. At least you can see them coming, you know.
And I might mention, he has been the
biggest
supporter.
And they feel overtly anti-working class. It's not just about race, you know what I mean?
Right. He's been the biggest supporter of Obama. And, I mean, he supported
Bernie Sanders?
Sanders. He supported him on military spending, you know, his various invasions. He supported him on his health care. I mean, he's been a strong supporter. But he has gotten his rewards because they have created a lot of – they have earmarked a lot of military spending to Vermont because, you know, he's been a good senator, you know. Share with us a little bit about Dean Capone because you've met him. He's right there in your neighborhood.
Yep. What about him?
Share with us who is he?
He's originally from Philadelphia. His family were in the unions. He's lived down in South Florida, I believe, for 30 years now. He's out of St. Petersburg. It's about 45 minutes from me. I met him the other day at the Revolutionary Caucus. He considered himself revolutionary, not a reformist. And I'm glad that the Socialist Party is taking the stance. You know, there was a recent article from the Socialist Party website on this as well about Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. It's good that we're letting the working class and the left in this country know that we're distinguishing ourselves from them and that we're not reformists and we're going to bravely come out with a more revolutionary stance. Now, there was debate within the Revolutionary Caucus, and there was just a cadre of people there with Dean present over in St. Petersburg. There was debate over what language you should use when we're speaking to the public and depending what audience. But essentially, we're not reformists, and we shouldn't be afraid to say that we're not reformists. I mean, you can use different words. Like, for example, I'd say replace the system, because if you say something like overthrow, that could be misinterpreted, you know.
Right.
So I'm just saying we need to replace the current system. The current system is not sustainable.
Like I said,
our very survival, if we maintain this capitalistic system, we could end as a human race right there.
Right. Well, I think even the capitalists realize the way it's going, it's not sustainable. And what they're doing is leading us to a war, a world war, just so that they can be able to have armies. They will have armies on both sides, and then they create their own results. Because we had to realize that wars are the greatest creators of wealth for the banks and the ruling elite.
And then the drug trade as well.
I have around 30 seconds to wrap this up. Just could you give out your contact information? I greatly appreciate you joining the program today.
My pleasure. I'm on Ruthann's and Stewart's Facebook page. You can find me on Facebook, Al Suarez, Suarez. I'm an author and activist out of Tampa, Florida.
Al, I really appreciate you joining the program today. Al Suarez from Tampa, Florida. And I look forward to having our listeners to join us in 2 weeks. We will not be on Labor Day. Join us in 2 weeks on Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. Thanks again, Al. Thanks again, Ruthann. See you then.
Sure. Thank you, guys. You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Karen, you were going to introduce everything?
Oh, no. Sorry. Hello. Yes, this is the dialogue, and my name's Karen Patrick. And, I meant to introduce the topic, but, hey, whatever gets us going.
That was awesome. I was, like, so sitting there waiting. That was great.
It was so dead air. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. That was brilliant.
Part of the need for to be the dialogue is we've got to talk, right?
A little bit of that, yeah. Oh, that's so funny.
So this is the dialogue, right? Yes. Karen has a great topic tonight. We're joined by Ken Withrop and myself. Karen.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello. Yes, hey. Okay, yeah, I'd like to introduce the topic. It's the topic is kind of part of how my life has developed in different seasons of my life, and it's called sheltering, S-H-E-E-L-L, sheltering. And the basic concept here, and I've actually known people to have done this when they were trying to kind of get back on their feet financially or whatever, to take over either a small home or a tiny home, or a barn, or an older home, or a chicken coop. I even saw one do this to a chicken coop. And the idea is to make a human, habitation, more or less, by starting with the fact that the building was the shell. So, and where I actually experienced this myself was on a boat. I actually took a small 25-foot Bayliner boat, and I created a home out of it that I lived in for a couple of years. So, when we have had in the past here in the United States of America, that we have had, like housing developments. And then what would happen is someone would buy a lot and then they would, get it approved for the sewer and the water and the, the electricity and all the systems. And then the house would be built. And that's basically how we have been doing property, through, developing the United States, basic system of housing. And we are in a very weird place now in our global economic system, the United States system, and also the kind of failure, in a sense, of real estate as we know it, okay? Home ownership and home occupation as we know it, with, of course, a record number of homeless people. And so I've watched various people who, for whatever reason, they found themselves really in dire need of housing, and they kind of went with this concept of shell sheltering. So I wrote down the five systems of shell sheltering, and the five systems are what's necessary, to live in a house. And the first one is the water system, the second is the sewage system, the third system is the energy system, the fourth system is the infrastructure, so that would be to look at the shell and see, make it more, structurally sound. And then I put down the fifth system as the communication system, so that would have been like your telephone and your television and your cable and things. We're dependent on that now in modern society. And the idea here is to take this concept that I've actually seen people already do, but this would be to expand this concept. To have people take over, like in my neighborhood, we have a kind of a housing development area that is in its senior years. I don't know how to put it any other way, and we have decreasing occupancy of homes, we have dilapidation of homes, they fall apart or their systems are broken, We have lots here, but we have a lot of homes that are not occupied that are boarded up. Some of them are somewhat structurally sound, but some of these systems in the home have broken down, or the person was not able to continue with the bank loan, or there was some kind of financial breakdown. And if we were talking about a restart of housing people, the idea would be to replace all of these systems with not the grid. Okay, most of these systems are connected to the grid. The water system is part of the grid. The water system is the city. The sewage has got this, you know, the sewer. The energy systems is usually the power company. And, like, the communication is usually, like, you know, cable that's built in and all this. Replace all of these systems. We would be able to rehome people by replacing these systems with off-the-grid technology. So that's kind of the idea, and we can get more into the different kinds of technology that can actually be brought into a home that is, you know, a shell. It's just a shadow of its former self. It's just a shell. And I have known people who have lived in, like, one room of the house and kind of almost, like, camped, basically, until they were able to, of course, rebuild the home. But this would be a little quicker because you would be able to do, for instance, a solar panel to start with your energy, or a compost toilet for your toilet, that sort of thing. So that is the topic, how to redevelop off-the-grid living if we're going to continue to have this unmonetized, you know, a very low monetized society.
Well, that was very well described. I have been, pardon me, I've been fostering that on my property and throughout my life for a very long time, in some form or another, because I flipped houses for a living for like 6 years. I did like 150 homes, and
wow.
When I moved into the when I moved into the house I'm in now, it was full of junk and animals, and it took me 3 months to get just the first floor livable. And we actually lived; our bedroom was the living room for Christmas. And we moved in, like, right before Christmas, and I had the bathroom, kitchen, dining room, the two front rooms of the first floor were the only thing we could live in. And I had roommates that took over the attic, and they prepped the attic for themselves. And I've always had, basically, the room before the attic and the attic of this house had always been a makeshift apartment, as in we shared the kitchen communally, and we shared the bathrooms. But everything else was up in that room. We put a lock on the door, and they had everything. If they cooked up here sometimes, you know, people would keep fridges and keep their food in there, and that was their, you know, their shell. And we slowly doctored up and turned it into what it is now, because people were living in there, we would make changes over time. And then when I took the attic over, I ended up taking my office that was over the garage, which is a disconnected building, that was for Green Farms, and I gave it to Gabe, who had the attic space. So when the attic space was done, I took it over. It's where I'm sitting right now, and that is now where, like, I do all my work, and that is my art space. And I gave him my old art space, which is a really nicely done office. And it had no amenities out there, just, you know, electricity, really well-done room and insulated. And, you know, it was designed to be an off-the-grid building with minimal impact. So, like, it's heavily insulated. And I went room by room and designed it similar to the way I designed, you know, the buildings for the farms. And so that's where Gabe is staying right now. And then we just started the next phase of the project, which is the composting toilet. So we went right for the Humanure book, and I took on the first step, and our next step is to go, okay, what's needed? Well, we realized that we're going to need to make, like, a composting toilet system that also allows for a urinal. And then what do we do with the urinal? Well, all that water's got to go down to a little treatment spot in the garage, and that then feeds the garden that's going to offshoot the garage. So we've been planning this, and basically I use people, cheap rent, and then they catalyze the projects because they're like, hey, I need this, and then we go do it. And that's how we got the house done, and that's how we're doing that. And you described it perfectly. We're doing it not really It's just low impact living and develop making it better, you know, with that rent. That rent facilitates when money is loose projects. So the next one is to build a much more, I guess, acceptable composting toilet, because right now it's basically we started with basics, which is cedar chips in a bucket and a toilet seat. And then I am now making the vented outhouse room within there, all the composting toilet amenities at an RV or what's required by code in Indiana. Because in Indiana, they allow composting toilets in houses. You can have up to two families using a composting toilet. Can't be commercial. And so I'm like, okay, cool, you know. So I'm going to – oh, what was that?
I was just going to say, well, then that brings up my question. Because, you know, what you're doing, aside from the off-the-grid, but, I mean, you know, living in the house and working on it at the same time, I mean, people have done this for a long time.
Yes.
But when Karen was talking about, like, just a shell in the neighborhood, and you just mentioned code, and so I wanted to bring that up. So if there's a house down the way and you know some people who really need a place to live and that house has been pretty much trashed, you know, the pipes are broken, there's no electricity, on and on, and if they move in, like, you know, we would say squatters, how does that work code-wise? I mean,
it
just depends on where you live because you may be thrown out. But if you buy the house...
If you buy the house, you could be kicked out if it is not... The health department requires that human waste and heat are, processed by whatever municipality codes are there. The health department and human waste are what dictate, ultimately, not even heat, because you can get around that and stay in a house without heat, and you won't get kicked out unless you have children. They'll kick you out. The DCFS will take the children, and then you'll be removed from the house. But ultimately, what it boils down to is waste removal, processing of waste. And if you don't have coating to cover compost toilets, you're tied to their grid. If you have a septic system, cool, you're off the grid. But if you have children and you are in a house squatting, the owner is who kicks you out, not the town, you know. Unless it's on tax sale or the owner is inaccessible, they can look into it. But technically, the owner is the one. If the house is too dilapidated, the town or neighborhood can file for a condemnation, and then the owner has to rectify all the components to get out of condemnation, which is that it's unlivable. When you condemn a house, it's unlivable. Not that you force it to be torn down. You made it, you legally bound it to be unlivable. And what I got into with flipping houses is I would buy these unlivable homes. I mean, I thought there was houses where I could see the sky from the basement. I've run packs of feral dogs out of houses to work on them. The house I'm in now, I had to kick squirrels and raccoons out just to get in the upstairs, you know, like they were bedded in there. And it gets real tricky because once you open your doors to county, they are now legally bound to push those codes. So when you start going at them saying, "How's the homeless?" you have to have some sort of acceptable plan for their waste removal, because that is when the health department comes in. Everything else, you know, you're at your own risk, and if you have children, DCFS jumps in. But if you are, like, a couple, and you're living in a house with no heat, electricity, if the house ain't falling apart and you're not running water that's, like, freezing and damaging other property, you're pretty much on your own. But whoever owns that house can kick you out. So there are no unowned houses. It's not – somebody holds title at all times. There are no titleless buildings. It just doesn't exist because what happens, like a car, somebody claims it or someone's name is on that title, and they are legally responsible for any damage that it inflicts on neighboring properties. So that is how that all boils down. So your waste removal, say, you know, you're shitting in a bucket, and you're, you know, like contractors will do this. We call it, you know, the contractor toilet is basically a toilet seat, a bucket, and a garbage bag. And then you deal with that. You put, you know, people, you know, throw it in the dumpster or whatever, because you don't have running water and sewer yet when you're starting a house from scratch. And, like, I grew up as a contractor. Like, I kept a phone book, and that was my toilet paper because it was real durable. And I always kept – I kept all my bags from all of my hardware stores I used, and I kept 1 5-gallon bucket. That bucket was my support system. I would use that, and all my waste would then – and I take it home. I would deal with it. If I didn't have a dumpster available on site, I would deal with it. But not everyone's that responsible. Now, when you go to squat – the police can come if the health department is asks them to if you're not handling your garbage. So when you go to shelling, that is the main component that is at the battle right now. You know, everything else is frill, and by code it's there's no real legality saying yay or nay. But when you get into I'm using power, you now have to be under code. If you've got electricity going in there, then you know, you have to look at the other amenities that are tied to it. If you've got gas going in there, you have to look at the other amenities going in. If you've got water, you have to have heat. If you bring in city water or you tie in a well, it's going to run on electricity if it's a well. If it's city has a requirement that you have to have heat in the house at all times. They can come because their meter, their property, can crack while freezing. And then you are then liable for the cost of that. But they, in turn, step up early and say, if it freezes, you know, if you have no heat and they find out, they cut your water off. Because they can't have the pipe bust in the house, because then they can ultimately get sued somewhere down the line for damage to the property. So because they were, yeah, it's everything teeters on each other. And it's very, like, it's not a difficult process, but nobody wants to tackle the regulation dominoes that are lined up. And it's that's where the squatter issue, like back with Occupy, and they were like, put people in homes, and nobody really looked at the infrastructure, tried to it, and wanted to do the work to back that up. No investor wants to do it, and it costs money. And that's, like, I'm all about this. This is, like, my, you know, this is my one of my biggest passions is because I grew up in it, and I just know it so well, but it's housing. I love the shell concept. It takes very responsible people to do it, though. And
right. Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And that's what they're scared of are the irresponsible people riding the bandwagon, just squatting for free so that they could, you know, basically lay around, play Xbox, and smoke pot. That's what they're scared of. Does it really happen? Really, no. But there are people that do squat and do end up in spots where they have no heat for months and or no amenities, and they technically have been put into a shell status, you know. It's happened
right
to me. And yeah, I've put myself in there purposefully, and I've had moments where, you know, it was really kind of, crap, you know, like this winter was very hard for me because I had no income and I'm digging for this investor for Green Farms and I couldn't take up any work. And I did for a minute, but then the work died because the winter got so harsh. So I was stuck for like 2 months, like, oh, crap, kind of situation. And
yeah, my first winter was, I didn't have, the power was not, level was not high enough because of an electrical problem, so I froze too.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That was
and
my first,
it's
first year of my Baylinner, yeah.
It's scary, you know, but you work your way through it. You know, you condense down to one room. It's easy to heat one room, you know.
Yeah.
And, and we got through it fine, you know. Ultimately, everyone was fine. But there were some moments where, like, the house, where I have a busted pipe I finally just got around to fixing, that popped over the winter. And that busted pipe, it was funny, Angel, when he came out to stay, I had that line cut off. He came out to stay, and we fixed it because he was just like, let's get this done. So we ripped the wall out, and we redid the line. Yeah, it was fun. It was, like, our second day hanging out. And But that thing busted in January or February, and I just had no money, so I just cut the cold line off going to the upstairs bathroom, and only hot water went out there because that was the cold line that busted. And
What you're saying, how ready communities are to condemn your effort or to, you know, do code enforcement, and there's a lot of that I can understand. Because I do see that this would have to be a community change, not just a, somebody wants to go squat or whatever. This would have to be a community value
absolutely.
Change to facilitate this. And as far as I can tell, this project could work, but it's going to require that people become aware and like you said, try to encourage and empower the responsible people. And to be encouraged and supported and maybe financially assisted. But it's like, to me it's like, okay, the value system is showing already of many communities. They would rather have people be homeless. They would rather have dilapidated, and I don't understand that because you're losing your community that support, you're losing people that,
here's
the
core reason why it's happening.
Yeah.
They're making
there's
two things. Is one, they're making more money sitting on it than they are dumping it. But two, they're saving money by not hiring somebody to manage that process because you have just gone into a landlording process, which now you are property management, and it is a very difficult business. I never want a landlord again. And I'm a very nice and easygoing person, and I can't stand that business because basically the people you're dealing with have problems. And when people have problems, your paycheck resides on their solving their problems. The bank, in general, is so disconnected from that tenant that it's not even a manageable process at that point. They are better off, in their eyes, better off sitting on a dead property because they can ultimately sell it off when the market comes up. They can write it off as a loss. They got a million ways to sit on these properties money-wise, and the only way that you're going to get them to let it go is when they collapse and they have to dump their inventory. And when they dump that inventory or they stop paying the tax bill and the city or the county, takes it back. And a lot of that happens. And Gary, right now, that's where I was today. I was a buddy of mine who I used to flip houses with. Since I'm waiting on my build permit for the farm, I had like 4 weeks of dead time. So I started working with him again. And so I'm out there today, back where I was 10 years ago, and I'm out there working on houses with him. And he's getting into the tax sale process, so we start talking about that. And what basically happens is a bank will foreclose, and the bank will sit on it, and then what they'll do is they will basically dump it off to somebody, or they will gauge out how long they'll pay taxes before it becomes a loss, and then they let it go. And what they do is they buy bulk. They take on bulk, and that's like packages of like 100 properties, 300 properties. And I got involved working as a consultant analyzing 400 properties in this region, Gary mostly, that were bought by guys in California. And they hired a broker to find the properties. They didn't even know what they bought. They just bought a package. And then they hired this broker who I worked for. And for 3 months, I had a map in my car and a gas card, and I found all the properties. Then I did all the title searches, found all the possible owners that were available, and then budgeted or wrote up budgets and build plans for the ones that were worth salvaging. And then I wrote up sales plans for the ones that were to just be sold as, a fixer-upper. And then wrote up the ones that were not even worth engaging in and should be tore down or, found to get rid of some other way. And so I got really, really, really in-depth knowledge of that process. And now I'm looking at it, and that's pretty much how it goes. Foreclosure, bank cuts their losses at some point, goes to tax sale. But there is such a movement of housing where they kind of like triple milk the cow. Sometimes they'll milk it 10 times. They'll buy a house, fix it up. The tenant comes in, doesn't rent to own, or even better, buys it. They have, their life goes to crap, that bombs, and the house ends up back on the market like 5 years later, and somebody buys it again for like a couple grand. And it becomes a money funnel, and money just runs through these buildings, and yet they technically had been paid off like 20 years ago, but they just keep generating money, and that's what happened to the housing market.
Sure, but that's I wanted to ask Karen about the boat. What was the circumstances? Did you know the people that owned it, or did you actually buy it? Or
no,
I actually
purchased it. It was rather humorous. The gentleman I purchased it was he was an alcoholic, and we shook on the deal, and I bought him a beer, and I left the bar, and he kept drinking, and he sold it to five other people. So we all had to pile into the marina office and figure out who was the first buyer, which was me. So,
that's
community. That's a funny community there. But this is a very weird side effect of all the housing issues is that there's people who, you know, of course we were just this killer Great Depression too we have going on. People, you know, are trying to figure out how am I going to live, how am I going to be, you know, have a roof over my head. And so what you would see is you would see people who would have a downturn, lose a job, whatever would happen, and they would lose their home, but they still had a boat. So there's several ways people got into boats. One of them was they either sold their home, there were some retirees there, sold their home and then moved on to their boat, or they had a houseboat, which is a few of those. Or they would, have their boat, lose their home, and end up on their boat as liveaboards. There was a bit of a cap on liveaboards, but the other way you could get a boat was they would have boats that some of the owner would abandon. They would stop paying the slip fee, and they would go to auction. So sometimes the boats would go to auction, sometimes the boats would go to salvage, depending on, you know, the condition of it. But they kind of changed hands. I mean, it was like horse trading. It kind of changed hands. The other dynamic that was going on was of course, boats. Now, the interesting thing about a boat versus a house is the fact that you cannot finance it and do that thing that you were just talking about, Kenny. So this is more of a raw reflection of our economy in a microcosm than housing is.
Uh-huh.
Housing still has that banking component, that you know, magical fairyland component of investment and banking. Boats are a raw resource. It's just straight up, straight down, like a used car somewhat. So we would see situations where you'd have a boat that, like 7 or 8 years ago, you know, when we first started this whole rigmarole of the Great Depression too, they would be, you know, a $60,000 boat that you would go to auction and you could buy it for $500. Now, the only caveat there is you have to have a slip. So you have to pay, you know, $300, let's say, a month for having it be in the marina. So that would look like your rent, basically. And then you'd get in there, and you'd go through these systems, and it would take a while to figure out, you know, are my systems all the way up or down or what? And until you sorted out your systems, your sewage and all that, you would, like, have a porta-potty, or you'd have – we had a composting toilet, so I know about that. Or you'd have a boat sewer system that was pumped out by sewage services. Or I had – my Bayliner had water issues, so I had to deal with water issues primarily on that one. That part of the boat was – it was, you know, 1970, circa 75 boats, so that was pretty dilapidated. The electrical system was kind of okay, like half of it worked. So this was that kind of shell living. And some people really – you know, one gentleman was very resourceful and took his boat that he bought from pretty raw deal. I mean, it was a catamaran in pretty bad shape. Brought it all the way up to where he was running quite a few of his systems in off of solar. He had enough deck space to do solar. Some people put wind generators on the boat, and the boat's kind of a thing where you're eventually going to leave the shore and go out in the middle of the water. You're going to need to have these systems available anyway. So there was marine systems and things and services that would get you there. we didn't really have the coding issue to have to deal with. And that would also be true of other types of funny little things that people would, you know, there was a one organization that was turning, I don't know if they're still around, containers from trucks they were turning into small, tiny homes. And there's another outfit out there that's actually building tiny homes. So there's this kind of a push, a little bit, an idea that rehoming a lot of people is going to be, well, shrinky-dink. We're not going to have the big houses maybe like we used to because people just don't have the finances for that anymore.
You know, a lot of people are going to tiny homes because they're tired of having all this shit to worry about. And so to simplify. And there's a lot
totally. It's like the RV complex. It's the same as the boat thing, you know. There's people moving in RVs. Same, like you, Ruthann, you hit it on the head. It's not only are you simplifying your stuff, you know, but you're also simplifying your bills, you know. Like you're in there, you know, changing your whole lifestyle. You're like, let's get rid of junk, too. One thing that a couple ideas I've been playing with, and I'm starting with this house. First off, like Green Farms, the partners, shot off and made a secondary company. And their goal is to, in Gary, the guy I was working with today is actually probably going to be the first guinea pig homeowner to do this.
Okay.
The landlord puts up a house. And then in the garage of the house, we build a vertical farm and supply a business for the tenant of the house. The tenant
wonderful.
Then does a land contract with the homeowner, and they live rent-free, as in the business in the garage pays all the utilities and rent and gives them a paycheck. So they can go full-time on this. And what we're looking at is getting people who are on assistance and going, let's get you off assistance but give you a career, not get you off so you end up back on it later. You walk out with the home on a credit deal with the homeowner, no bank included, and you get a business that you can own too, and you walk out of this and it's all said and done, and we make it cheap enough and viable enough so that it actually happens. Now, that's the one we're working on now, and it probably is going to happen. Today was a weird day, and it all came down today, and it was pretty neat. The other one, which is what I'm doing with the property out here that I'm on, I got I was looking at eco-villages and communes and intentional living, and was like, how do you do this without having, you know, 800 acres and a bunch of homes backed up in the woods? Or, you know, like, how do you do this in a city? How do you create an intentional village in a city? How do you create an intentional village? Here's how you do it. You create a trust, because one of the beauties I learned from all the corrupt, you know, real estate people, how did they hide themselves and protect themselves from lawsuits? They made trusts, and they would bury the houses in trusts. They would get balloon mortgages and balloon insurance, policies. And then, like, they would put, like, 10, 20 houses in the trust, and then the insurance covered the trust. The mortgage covered the trust. So you buy a bunch of houses within a community. They don't have to be linked. And you put them in the trust, and you own them as in the trust. Now, this trust now becomes an intentional community. And what you do is you set the same idea up. Hey, you're going to stay here rent-free. You're going to stay here utility-free because you're going to live lighter. There will be no mortgage. These homes are owned outright, which means you go, like, the guy, there's got to be some philanthropist involved, and that's where I was getting into. That's what I want to do. Buy these homes, put them in the trust, and they are off-grid buildings. You take an on-grid building and get it as off-grid as you can. Get it so it has no property tax, because now it's underneath a not-for-profit. Each property is now a component of the not-for-profit, as in it grows certain vegetables that are given away to a food co-op or to a food pantry. Or they're, you know, it's a component of the bigger business. And this business is basically a commune. This commune operates like a village. So it has the healer lives in the house. So, like, somebody might be, you know, an acupuncturist. That acupuncturist runs their business from their home. The home is in the trust. The trust protects the home from taxes and from it being lost. And this person then stays in the house, and as long as they operate within the commune, which is operate within whatever the parameters they set up in their contract of what business they run, and they supply that minimal good, that means you have just, you're going below rent value. So this house, nobody owns any of these. Even the owner doesn't own them. The trust owns them. And so what they would end up is, like, say, Karen, you moved in one of my houses down the street. Now, we're calling it mine just, you know, for, you know, shits and giggles. But really, the trust owns it. I don't even own the houses, but I set this up. You move in there, and you are operating as a researcher, period, is what you like to do. So you're a writer or whatever. You plug in enough input into the community to be a viable entity in the community being whatever this not-for-profit, whatever it is. You know, like for mine, here is an education center and research center for natural construction and art, agriculture. So, you know, sustainable living stuff. So then you're involved in the sustainable education laboratory process. You may have one of the components of the lab set up on the property, and or you may be the researcher for this or blah, blah, blah. And it's minimal, but as long as you operate that and it operates on a part-time basis, you don't put more than 20 hours a week into this component so that you can earn cash on the side in whatever form you need for whatever else. And the house has no utilities. You never pay a bill because it is off-grid. And the house also has no mortgage because it's protected underneath this trust.
Wonderful.
So that's what we're trying to do. That's the round, like the rough of what I want to set up out here to solve that housing process.
Get back into the shell.
What was that?
I want to get back to the shell structure, just a person.
Get the details. Yeah, let's say they walk into one. Great, yeah.
So what kind of things have you run into, Karen? I mean, because there's all forms of things, and I knew some people who were living in yurts and this kind of thing on some property in the country that was owned by other people, actually, that put festivals on there. Is that considered shell housing? I mean, when you just show up with the, like, a yurt, or they were also somewhere making things out of, you know, those big circus billboards that are like 50 feet, whatever, those canvas thingies, they were using those to form a structure. Would that be what you consider shell living? Because they had no
The basic idea is get the rain off your head, you know, to start.
Yeah.
And you know, get out of the weather. And then so you know, that gets into the different kinds of technologies that could do this, and again, we'll have to go to the like Kenny's idea of trust or something like that to just say, "Hey, we're well into the level of legal now. Now what do we do, right?" And that's probably the trickiest part. And of course, we need to have people who are, you know, self-responsible, or, you know, it has to be people who want to commit to this kind of living. And I really have talked to so many people who are willing to do this. In the community I was before, in Olympia, Washington, we had a homeless camp that became a permanent housing, but it went from a tent city to small buildings and a community. And it was because the people that were in the community was supported by the community, and the people that lived in the community, abided by the rules. They actually were self-governing, and they were able to continue the process until they have a more stable environment for them to now live. So I kind of watched that grow up. So now they had grid. You know, they kind of were staying on the grid more or less. You know. But this would be getting off the grid. This is a component that helps kind of overcome, like, situations where you have abandoned houses and someone goes in and gets all the copper piping, which actually happened to a house my parents owned. Someone stripped out all the wiring and the piping and everything.
Very common. Yes.
So you got the shell that now has no water systems or to speak of or whatever, or the sewage is damaged or all this. So I wrote down for each of these systems, I did write like one idea for a technology that would help with the five systems. And I can't speak to this one. I would ask Kenny to, is the terraformers. Now, you talked about Angel Marrero, and he has this terraformer thing. So this would be the idea. The first thing is you've got to have water systems, and that's one of the tougher ones to overcome. But we do have an aging infrastructure, and many, many, many houses have all kinds of problems with water. Even when they're sort of, quote, unquote, up to code, they're still having issues. We have aging infrastructure. I grew up there, I spent a number of years, my growing up years in Napa, California. Napa just had an earthquake, so you'll get damage to the water systems there. And that's a lot of the reasons why I was very committed to the Artesia Well Project, is to make sure people have water. So this is an idea, this terraformer idea, I'm very curious about. So I was hoping that Kenny would tell us about it.
Okay.
Well,
Kenny?
The big one is, like, theirs runs, it could pull 30 gallons a day, roughly, out of the air in the desert. And a typical house, you don't really use 30 gallons a day. A typical household of, say, four or five people, you're looking at maybe 10 gallons a day on the highest scenario. It's a gallon a day to dump your toilet. So let's say you move to composting toilets. You cut out water consumption on the toilet, so you're just rinsing urine, you know, at that point. And then when you wash your hands, like, I grew up in California, so, like, I knew how to, you know, how to be frugal with my water. You know, if it's brown, flush it down. If it's yellow, let it mellow. You know, I do it here now, and I'm on well and septic. I can flush all day long, and but we still do it. It's just a habit. And when you get into those components, a terraformer that can pull 30 gallons a day is an extremely high amount. So that's really good. And it doesn't tap the water table. It pulls the humidity from the air. So now let's assume you got, you know, the issue I guess I have with the terraformer being max run is, has anyone done the math on how that would impact the humidity of an area if you had condensed housing? I don't know. You know, that's a problem in itself. What if you had 50,000 cars running, you know, on a block? That block's going to get really hot, you know. So the same thing, you're pulling a lot of humidity. But I don't think pulling 5 gallons a day is going to affect anything, because households, that's about the average consumption. Now, terraformer, too, run by solar panels, so it's outside. The only issue is then in the winter. You know, you're governed by the, by the region, the temperance of the region. Oh. And but I'm a firm believer. Terraformers and composting toilets and solar panels are what every house should have. And then all of a sudden the shell living becomes very viable. There's a lot of things, like we had some friends. I've always had somebody staying in a tent on my property, too. It's very common here. And I had a friend who, one of our old roommates, ended up staying on their farm for an entire summer. And they made a little tent compound and stayed there for like 3-4 months. And it was an experience, is the way she put it, but she ended up moving back out here after that was done. And it's doable, but they went in, they didn't plan as well as they could have. But it was just that whole, I witnessed the shell living constantly. I'm always integral to some day-to-day thing for me. So it's really cool because I get to see it on the micro scale, but I also see it on the political macro scale. How does it affect the community, and how does it affect it? Because codes are for public safety. That's the whole point. And it's their best judgment of a scenario. That's where you got to focus. House people.
You're breaking up.
Yeah, he's having a bit of a breakup.
I know we're getting a storm here, but I can hear you fine. I don't hear. Okay,
Now
he dropped. Okay, he just dropped.
Okay, I'll go ahead and talk about the two other issues on this list, and he can call back.
The five sub here. Yeah.
Yeah, it was water. sewage, and he talked about composting, energy, solar and wind, which is great, or also there's the concept of free energy, which is kind of on the back channels, and people are talking about things that Tesla, you know, experimented with. So that's, again, you know, more conventional would be the solar and wind. And then the two other ones were infrastructure and communication. And infrastructure was you're in the shell, and now you want to expand the space, like you're in one room, you want to expand it. It's just simply trying to improve the infrastructure, insulate things better, you know, repair things. And in the community I was in before, we had a restore. We had a Habitat for Humanity restore where you could go. I actually went there quite a bit and got supplies that were from, you know, where they had torn down a building or there was some construction, and instead of throwing it away, they took it to the restore. So you were able to get, you know, different components of your home from restore or free cycling. So it's trying to set up in your community. Again, this would be the community piece of it, is to encourage the community to start recycling, free cycling, you know, building materials. And then the communication piece of it is a little bit different. I came up with, you know, right now we have a Wi-Fi, we have satellite, which is very, very expensive. But I consider communication very, very important part of modern society, because so many people work using the Internet, have their education through the Internet, and also this is how you actually find out how to do some of this stuff. Typically, if you go in the library, you're not going to necessarily find out everything you need to know about whatever it is you're trying to build or do, whereas you could go on the Internet and see a YouTube video of how to, you know, take care of a compost toilet, or how you would, you know, grow something organically and whatnot.
I think I've seen, like, almost... Well, I know I haven't seen all of them, but I've seen so many videos for rocket stoves. Yeah, I know.
So I consider the communication piece very important, and I'm just going to throw something out there that's kind of interesting. And that was this outer net, and we did have it listed, you know, as one of the topics. The outer net is kind of a concept that's new. It is a global kind of effort, and what it is the idea of getting low-orbit Earth satellites. So this would not necessarily be something somebody did themselves. This would be, you know, kind of almost like a global effort or a shared humanity effort, is to, rather than having the Internet, we would have satellite network created as a group effort to lower the cost or get it to almost no cost for our access to communication and making unlimited communication, because I know that, you know, I'm a net junkie, so I have, you know, had a fluctuating income, so I have had, like, times where I had such a hard time getting enough Internet time to complete a project. And, you know, some people are really scrambling for, you know, Wi-Fi access or Internet access or broadband access. So this outer net thing was a concept where it would really, we could really revitalize. And then the other thing, we have the telecom, you know, companies. I worked for one. I felt very guilty. That was a job I quit. It was terrible. But it was like the telecom companies, you know, they say you have unlimited, Wi-Fi or something on your little broadband card or whatever. It's not unlimited. I absolutely know it was not unlimited, because I would run every month right up to the limit, you know, I would or over, and then I'd be, you know, have to wait a week until it started back up. So I paid per month for my broadband card, and it was 5 gigabytes, push and pull through, you know, uploading and downloading. And I mean, I was watching that every day, so that I would, you know, almost ration myself, because I was a heavy user.
Had something like that. It was horrible.
Yeah.
And they couldn't do this, they couldn't do that, they couldn't do the radio shows, they couldn't do YouTube, they couldn't do this. I mean, just disgusting.
Well, this outer net would be basically free and unlimited, access to the Internet. And I believe that would be such a huge boost to all economies, because then you'd
is there
be
a
able
group
to do all those
putting
things.
That together?
Yeah, that it's called outer net. You Google that, find outer net, and it is a online crowdfunded kind of project. I've got to upgrade my knowledge about that, because it was just kind of an idea a while back, and then I have to upgrade, like, how far they've gotten. But it's a wonderful concept, and I believe it would just completely revolutionize, because I know, Kenny, when I've had to call you, you've had, were you standing on your some kind of propane tank or something out in your yard just to be able to talk to me on your phone. Are you getting better service?
I've heard
people
talk about this before. Outernet. So I'm very interested in finding out more about that. Yeah,
me too, man. That's something I did not know was going on. I thought I was pretty aware of all the, you know, really, you know, the, I guess, progressive pushes for society and breaking off of the grid. And I had no clue that somebody had actually tackled that and it got it moving. That's great. If it's into a public funding status, it is definitely, that's a good sign. That is a really good sign.
I do not know how far they've gotten. I'm on the mailing list for it, but I've been so busy with other work. It had been like bookmarked to go see, okay, how far have these guys gone? Is it something to where they have links that I can now, like, you know, push on Facebook or share with my friends?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to kind of want to, I'm going to make myself catch up with it this week. I'm actually considering, the opportunity came up in my community. When I was in my last community, I became very concerned about people, and my daughter, who is disabled, is in this situation where she is medically dependent on an airbed. She's got a pressure sore. So if the power goes off or whatever, they have a generator. They're
mm-hmm.
at home. But I was thinking of all these people who are now medically dependent on things working, and, you know, if you run out, you can have emergencies where they run out of fuel for the generator. I was interested, and I'm in discussion with some people here, to start an organization, a nonprofit, to try to get a solar panel system or make sure one, you know, room has a solar panel situation in the room or the nursing home or whatever it is, to where you'd be able to keep vital medical equipment going in an emergency. So this is in very early stages of discussion I'm wanting to do. I need to resolve the issue for my daughter long-term, you know, over the course of her life. You know, that's the situation for her. But I thought, well, gosh, if I'm going to solve the problem for her, I might as well solve it for other people. So I've been talking to people here in the community about that. So, you know, gridless is not just for, I'm going to save a few bucks or sell my power back to the power company. But it's also, you know, it's a life necessary thing as we have, you know, equipment and that sort of thing. So all of these topics are useful for multiple life situations.
Yeah. God, this is, I love this subject because it's everything I do. It's like what I live and breathe. I've been looking at it on the bigger scale. And I love that one thing, which I haven't really given you much airtime to do, was tackle the individual scale, the list, you know, because I keep going, oh, my God, because this is what happens when you get to that point, you know, and it's people are real serious about this. This is not – this is a very common thing right now. Everyone's looking at it. And to do it, like the checklist thing you came up with is I love, because that, you know, so you're going to – so let's say you inquire about it. I had a buddy that wanted to build a tiny home and park it on my property for 6 months and then move it somewhere else. So we've got into this, and it was like, that was the stuff we went in. And he's like, okay, he's a writer, so he needed internet access. He needed power. What are you doing with your waste, you know? And all of a sudden, he's like, do I just get an RV or should I build this? I'm like, well, you need a truck to pull it when you move it. And, you know, we got into all these aspects because he wanted to be disconnected, you know? He wanted to basically live in an RV is what it boiled down to. And I'm like, okay, so what do you do when you're trying to get mail? If you want to stay assimilated, you have to get a P.O. box. But, you know, where is this P.O. box? And once you're in the P.O. box, how much do you get a bank account? Or do you stay off of that? Are you going to ever deal with cash? And there's so many aspects to shell living that, you know, people have to look at, because it's a massive life change. Sometimes you're forced into it. You know, like you were saying, most of the homeless people who are very capable of getting back on their feet. They're not mentally ill. They aren't so trashed and disconnected in life that they can't reassimilate, you know, into some form of communal pattern. You know, those people are, it's a different animal at that point, you know, it's a whole nother complex of stuff to talk about. When you're talking, like, the family that lost their home and lost their job, and right. we're now homeless in a car, or staying at a friend's house in their basement for a minute while they figure things out. What do you do with your shell living? And it's there's so many components out there that are doable, and a lot of people get that front-end idea, you know, like, hey, fill up these vacant houses. Absolutely, but how do you do it? I don't know. You know, so I focused on that, and I never thought about how does this family even go from A to B? Let's say the house is available, but everything's missing. Or they can't get a job. They can move into the house, but they can only run the house for a month, and then their money's out. And so how do you sustain this living? And that list is definitely really cool, man, because I hadn't thought of it in that direction. I always thought big. I never thought about, well, what do you do to do the move?
I thought out five things, but I think you came up with more, and I think you came up with a great concept. I didn't really address food security in this one. I didn't address a home-based business, which I've had off and on over the years. It's a home-based business for part-time work. So I like that you brought those other pieces in there. So I'll tell you what I do. Ruth Ann, you have a Facebook page for this radio show. Is that correct?
Yes, it's called Aramarte Feel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was checking that out. I'll post at least these up on there so people can have a look.
Yes, please.
And
please.
Yeah, because this is kind of the basic, you know, basic human needs that you have to think of right away. And, of course, there's other ideas. And one thing I could tell you, too, is that I was told by a lady who really travels all the time, and she said as far as, like, the post office goes, you can have something sent general delivery to a local post office. Just it's general
yes,
delivery. They'll hold it.
Awesome.
And pick it up. Yes.
So
I've had to use that a couple
awesome. I didn't know that. Yeah. Me and Gabe is moving out soon, and we actually started this talk this week. He makes jewelry for a living. He does all his work from the Internet. And what we're doing is he's going to move out. Someone else has taken that space, and I'm going to run his warehouse for his Etsy store, which is basically a countertop, in the attic. And he's going to travel the country for the next year and basically use crystal digging locations and festivals as his venture points, where he's going to where he wants to end up. And so we started planning that. And how do you pare down to a couple bags? And the shell living concept came back again because he's like, well, I might do some camping on properties, and I might, you know, but I got to stay connected to the Internet. How are you going to eat? Well, I make enough money, I could at least buy food. And I'm like, okay, so how many couches can you serve? You know, we started playing through this whole scenario. And it's every individual or individual family is going to have a different dynamic. Like, Karen, if you were stricken homeless while you had your daughter, different dynamic than a 23-year-old male whose business is all done via Internet and post office. You know, so, like, everything's done via PayPal. As long as his phone's on, the dude will be working, you know, and as long as he can keep crystals and wire in his bag and his tools, you know, he's always got a way to make money. So, like, different people have different ways to do this, and it's very individualistic. You know, each scenario has a different agenda behind it that you have to cater to, and it's, I love the concept because it's, you know, have you seen the book Shelter? Have any of you seen this? It was done in the 70s.
No.
No, I take it no. Please go to the library and check it out, please. I'm telling both of you. This guy back in this shelter, and he's making a new book, and he is all about the shell housing concept. And what he did is he just looked at people who broke off the standard housing grid, and what did they do for shelter? Families living in shacks on the beach made out of driftwood, tree houses, living in trailers, living in old buildings. Like, that's what this book is. And he visits these people and interviews them, and then he's doing another one now, I hear. But he's got a website and a blog, and I'm just awesome. But the book came out in the 70s. It's called Shelter, and it really gets you into the concept of this. What is this? You know, how does someone do it? How do you make this so accessible that scared family who just got hit with a brick in the face isn't so scared now? We could do this. This information is not crazy.
Yes.
That's, I would really want to be a part of this. Yeah.
But our time, once again.
Oh, is that the music? Damn.
No, this happens.
Are we?
Every time.
Is next week Labor Day?
We won't be here next week, Labor Day.
Okay.
2 weeks.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
All right, bye, guys.
Happy holidays.
Have a good night. You
good
too.
Night. Bye-bye.